1 Samuel records the establishment of Israel's monarchy. Samuel served Israel faithfully as prophet, priest, and judge, and was directed by God to anoint Israel's first king, Saul, the king the people demanded. After Saul turned from God, David was anointed by Samuel to succeed Saul, thus establishing God's king, which paved the way for the eternal kingdom of Jesus.
1 Samuel chapter 20. Good to see all of you in the overflow as well. We know we got people in overflow. We're very excited about, you know, starting our new third gathering down at Granville Island sometime over the next couple of weeks. We're just waiting on them to finish. And so if you're newer here, we will have the two gatherings here as normal and an 11:30, which we really are asking some of you just to make your new home down there in the new theater that Theater Sports is putting up. They are well on their way. We're hoping to be in there on Easter Sunday, the 4th. But right now, I would say it's 50-50. But I watch, you know, Extreme Makeover, and they can put a house up in a week. So we figure they can get a theater up, right? We just need to get Ty on the job. Move the bus. Everybody weeps. We'll see the new theater. Be great. Yeah. And don't tell me you don't cry when they move the bus. Everybody cries when they move the bus. And if you don't cry when they move the bus, there's something wrong with you. 1 Samuel chapter 20. Every so often I attempt to introduce what I call $1,000 words. These are words that I think are really vital, yet maybe a little uncommon to the Christian faith. Vital, uncommon, yet I think color enhancing. And so every once in a while, I try to introduce words that are really vital, yet you may not have a great insight into them, but I think are necessary ones to have insight into them because they add definition and vibrancy and all of that to our faith. There is a common sort of idea or adage in Christian circles that, you know, we need to remove all the Christianese out of the church. And I think that adage comes from maybe a good place. We don't want to just say things that nobody understands, but I don't really think I agree entirely with that. I don't think our job is to remove all the wording from our faith. I think our job is to explain them. And so that's what I'm trying to do with this. I'm trying to explain certain words. I guarantee many of you know them already. I don't mean to suggest that I know them and you don't. I don't. I just want to try to explain and maybe see if we can get on a common footing as we go into things. The word I want to introduce really wraps up or encompasses a major tenet of our faith that we're going to walk through today. The word that wraps that up is the word covenant. That's our $1,000 word. Now, covenant is not really a word that is unfamiliar to most of us. I think most of us get the general sense of the word covenant generally. But what I want to do today is I want to see if I can take it to a deeper sense of the word. Let me explain why I want to walk through covenant with you by having you look at the first 8 verses of 1 Samuel chapter 20. It says this in verse 1, "Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my guilt and what is my sin before your dad, your father, that he seeks my life?' Jonathan said to David, 'Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father Saul does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so.' But David vowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes. And he thinks, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your father lives, there is but a step between me and death.' Then Jonathan said to David, 'Whatever you say, I will do for you.' David said to Jonathan, 'Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at table with the king, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan. If he says, good, it will be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that harm is determined by him. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a," here's our word, "into a covenant of the Lord with you." Let's just stop there. There's our word. That's why we're going to spend some time in it. First of all, let me just give you a simple definition of the word covenant. Covenant's a tough word to define, by the way. It's a lot of levels, a lot of layers to it, but simply, just for the sake of time and space here, the definition that I'm going to give you for covenant is, it's a contract, but it's more. It's a contract, probably more specifically, you could use the word oath or agreement. So it's a contract, an oath, an agreement, but it's a contract, oath, or agreement that is birthed out of intimacy. That is birthed out of intimacy and is founded in blood. No other way of putting that. I'll unpack that for you in a little bit. But it's an oath. It's a contract with intimacy bound by blood. Now, why do I say it's bound by blood? Well, literally in the Hebrew language, and I know all of us know Hebrew, but in the Hebrew language, the word covenant can literally be translated cut or divide. To make a covenant in the Hebrew language should literally be read to cut a covenant. I'm aware that comes from, I'll get to in a moment, but in the ancients, when two parties would make covenant, would cut a covenant with one another, what they would do to symbolically display the oath that they were walking into is they would take an animal and cut it in half. They'd cut it in half, put one piece over here, another piece over here, and they would walk between the two pieces. This walking between the two pieces of the sacrifice was called the walk of death. The walk of death. What you were saying symbolically was to the other and to the world around you that if I break this oath, may it be done to me what's been done to this sacrifice. So a covenant was, again, bound by blood, intimacy, very serious, all of those types of things. Where does this come from, by the way, this symbolic gesture, this walk of death? Well, when God makes his covenant with Abraham back in Genesis chapter 15, in that covenant, by the way, it's a covenant that we still live under in its fulfillment. But in that covenant, God sets up his covenant agreement with Abraham. But Abraham is given a deep sleep by God. A sacrifice is takes place. The two parts of the animal are divided. And while Abraham is sleeping under this deep stupor, God, through fire, through smoke, he walks through these two pieces, a demonstration to all that this covenant that he was going into, again, that we fulfill or live in the fulfillment of now, has been taken care of by God and God alone, that it's dependent upon God and God alone. Now, over the last couple of chapters, whether you realized it or not, we have seen a couple of really key aspects of what covenant looks like. Just hang a left, go back to chapter 18. Let me show you what I mean. So I've tried to define it for you. Now, let's see if we can kind of add more light on it by looking at some aspects that we learn about covenant displayed with Jonathan and David. Now look at chapter 18, first four verses. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him, David, as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant. There's our word. Made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. Now note verse 4, because in verse 4 we learn several really key things about covenant. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword and his bow and his belt. Let me highlight a couple things just from that one verse that we learn about covenant. First, what truth about covenant did Jonathan demonstrate when he gave David his robe? And make no mistake, it wasn't just any robe. It was a royal robe that Jonathan gave David. What kind of truth do we learn about covenant? Well, putting on the covenant partner's robe symbolizes putting on the partner's identity. The two become one. That if when you look at one, you are looking at the other. To see one is to see the other. Each partner is saying, I am dying to independent living and my rights. So we see this in the changing of clothes. Keep all of these things in mind because we're going to wrap this up at the end and it's going to be beautiful. We'll stand up and shout and cheer. It'll be great. It'll be fantastic. Secondly, what did the exchange of armor symbolize? He gave his armor, his sword, his bow. Well, armor symbolized, and I think we get this, defense, protection, The covenant partner was responsible for the other and to take on the other's enemies, and vice versa. So he was taking his clothes, his identity, switching, becoming one. He was taking on his armor, his protection, his enemies were one. And lastly, what did the exchange of the belt symbolize? Well, most agree that this symbolizes strength. But we learn more as well about covenant when you get into chapter 20. One of the questions that is answered for us is, how serious is covenant? Well, the seriousness of covenant is seen in verse 13 of chapter 20. Let me read it for you. We'll read it again later, but just to give you a sense, listen to the dialogue between David and Jonathan. But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away. We see here David's enemies became Jonathan's enemies, but what enemy is Jonathan talking about here? His dad. Covenant is serious. It supersedes and takes precedence over every relationship, even including, and we see it here, family ties. One more thing. What do we learn about covenant from chapter 20? And we'll get to this a little bit later. We also learn that it's covenant that's between two families, not just the individuals. So we see family, we see houses, we see lineage. Again, we see the covenant passing on to the descendants forever. We'll get to that a little bit. So that's covenant. That's some description of it. That's some definition of it. That's what we see, which should lead to the obvious question, I think, that some of you, most of you, should have right now. And that is, who cares? Who cares, man? Great. What difference does this make in my life in 2010? Covenant, great. David, John, great. Changing clothes, great. Whatever. What difference? I think it's a good question. I think that's a question that you deserve to ask. You have the right to ask. I'm going to introduce another word to you right now. This has nothing to do theologically, like covenant does with what we're talking about. But I want to introduce a word that will help us in answering that question, who cares? What difference does covenant make to my life today? The word is bastion. You know the word bastion? Bastion is like power, like a bastion of strength. Bastion has synonymously tied into it words like pillar, stronghold, foundation. I want to use that word bastion in connection with covenant to answer the question, what difference does covenant make to my life today? All right? Are you good with that? Okay. Got me worried. How are your brackets, by the way? Anybody here in March Madness? My brackets are terrible. But that's a whole other story. Let's walk through this. Four truths about bastion, that pillar, that mainstay, that citadel that is covenant. I want to highlight four things that we see in chapter 20. First, here's the first. The covenant is the bastion in times of uncertainty. We already read verses 1 to 8. Let me remind you, however, what we read. In verse 1, David is speaking to Jonathan, and he essentially says, what gives? Like, what the heck? That's verse 1. My life is unraveling. I'm running for my life. Everything is spinning out of control. People are trying to kill me. My life sucks. And it's because of your dad that my life sucks. I like verse 1. I like that verse 1 is there. I like that David is going through this period. Or at the very least, that he's not shy in sharing it. You know what I mean? So David is going through this unraveling, this uncertainty of his life. And Jonathan sort of makes it worse in verse 2. Right? Doesn't he? He's not a really good friend in verse 2. He goes, no, you're wrong. You're wrong. Your life doesn't suck. Don't you love hearing that when your life is going tough? No, it's not. Oh, okay. I feel better. I feel great now. Thank you. Right? I mean, that's verse 2. No, you're wrong. My dad's good. Me and my dad are like this, man. My dad tells me everything. Now, why is he doing this in verse 2? Well, this is a reminder of last week. What Jonathan is doing in verse 2 is he's still living in verses 6 and 7 of chapter 19. In verses 6 and 7 of chapter 19 was this protection of reconciliation. Remember that last week? Where Jonathan brings David and Saul together and there's this big reconciliation party. David is hanging out in the group. Jonathan is still there. But Jonathan has stayed in verse 7 because he doesn't realize what's taken place since verse 8 to the end of chapter 19, where spears being hucked at David, right? Having to escape through windows, soldiers coming to his hometown, this prophecy conference with naked kings, right? All of that. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, read it. It's unbelievable. All this stuff, he doesn't know that's taken place. So in verse 2, he's like, no, you're wrong, man. Remember, we reconciled. Which leads to verse 3, where David responds and says, hey, John, I'm on the edge of death here, man. Your dad wants to kill me. You're wrong. I'm running from my life, and I'll prove it to you. And what David does is he sets up a test situation that will verify that Saul is trying to kill him. That's what verse 5 is. David says, look, there's a feast that's supposed to be taking place. It's the new moon. It's a monthly festival. And you remember David, he's got a place, right? He plays the lyre. Everybody likes David. I don't know if that's the lyre. And he plays. He's got a certain level of prominence within the kingdom. So there's a big festival going on, this monthly festival. And if there's a festival going on, then a person like David in his position would be required, expected to be there. And David says to Jonathan, look, go to the festival, go to the banquet, sit at the table. And if your dad asks about me, tell him I've gone to Bethlehem for a big yearly party with my family. Right? Which begs again that question. Isn't this a lie? Have fun in your small groups again. You can unpack this. All right? So he comes up with this test situation. That's what's going. And what David says to Jonathan is, if he asks, where am I? And he responds, okay, then I'm okay. But if he gets angry, then you know he wants to kill me. So that's the test situation. Now, I want you to look at verse 8, because verse 8 begs an all-important question that will help us walk through the rest of this passage. And the question is this: why should Jonathan go through with this plan? Why should he? Jonathan has absolutely nothing to gain by going through with this plan. Jonathan is the rightful heir of the throne, at least from a worldly standpoint. He's the king's son. So why should Jonathan go ahead with this plan? He's got nothing to gain out of this. And I think David gets this. I think David conjures up this situation, this test situation, and that leads to what David says in verse 8. Take a look at verse 8 again. It says, therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Two big parts to this. One, David appeals to this covenant of the Lord that they have entered into back in chapter 18. Go along with this, because we are in covenant relationship with one another. But did you notice the second thing that stands out about half of this verse, verse 8, first half? What is so absolutely wonderful in this is how Jonathan should deal with David based on the covenant they are in. Did you see it? Take a look at it again. It's tasty. Look at verse 8. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant. Why? Why should I deal kindly with you? For you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. That's why. I love that. This phrase, deal kindly, is an absolutely important phrase in chapter 20. David is saying this: my life absolutely is unraveling. My life sucks. I'm running for my life. I have to come up with something to demonstrate that I'm not making this up. So I'm going to do this. And Jonathan, here's the deal. We've entered into covenant with one another. And based on that, I want you to go ahead with this with me. But I don't just want you to go ahead with it. I want you to go ahead with it and deal kindly in it. Like I said, that phrase, deal kindly, is important. It's a Hebrew word that comes up 250 times in the Old Testament. Sometimes based on context is translated mercy or steadfast love or loving kindness. Sometimes it's simply love. It has packed into it compassion and affection and loyalty and reliability and faithfulness. It's not just love, it's devoted love. It's not just love, it's steadfast love. To put it really simply, but importantly, it's the love of God the Father. Listen to the words found in Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. It says, "The Lord passed before that him as Moses and proclaimed, 'The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in,'" there's our word, "steadfast love and faithfulness." I want you to deal this way with me. We've entered this. I want you to deal this way with me. Look back at chapter 18. I want you to notice one other thing in connection with this before we move on to point two. And I want you to notice, we've already talked about the covenant they've walked into, but I want you to notice where this covenant is birthed out of. Look at verses 1 and 3 of chapter 18. I know we've read, I want to read it again. "As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." Look at verse 3. "Then Jonathan made a covenant with David." Why? Why'd you do it? Why'd you do it, Jonathan? "Because he loved him as his own soul." I want us to get this in discussion of covenant. I want you to know what you can count on when you enter covenant. I want you to know where covenant is birthed from. When you enter covenant, you have the assurance that you will be dealt kindly, with steadfast love, forever love. You also need to know that covenant and the opportunity for covenant relationship is birthed out of love. Now, why am I hammering on this? Why am I saying this? Well, you know we're going to get to Jesus, who ushers in a new covenant. And it was because God so loved the world that he sent Jesus. So when you go, what difference does covenant make in my life when my life is unraveling? It makes all the difference in the world. When everybody is scattering, everybody is forsaking, everybody is leaving, everybody is letting you down, you're in covenant with one who does not. Here's the second thing that we see about covenant in chapter 20, and that is the covenant is the bastion for uncommon faithfulness. Let's read verses 9 to 17. It goes on and says this, "And Jonathan said, 'Far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you?' Then David said to Jonathan, 'Who will tell me if your father answers you roughly?' And Jonathan said to David, 'Come, let us go out into the field.' So they both went out into the field. And Jonathan said to David, 'The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well pleased or if he is well disposed towards David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more. Also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety, may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, show me," here's our word again, "steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." You get a real clear depiction here of how Jonathan views the kingdom of David. It's a very telling statement. He's using forever language. Again, we'll unpack that a little bit. Verse 16, "And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, 'May the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies.' And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul." Now, I've said that the covenant is the bastion for uncommon faithfulness. There is uncommon faithfulness packed into the verses that I just read to you. But to understand this uncommon faithfulness demands that we have some idea of what's taking place and what would be normal or common for both David and Jonathan at this time. Firstly, let me see if I can help us. Firstly, the son of a king, as Jonathan was, didn't hand over his place to a rival as David was. This is not common. This is not culturally normative. He was the rightful next in line to the throne, Jonathan was, and what would have been normal would have been to have disposed of David. In fact, that's what, and we'll see this later in verses 30 and 31, what ticks Saul off so much with his son Jonathan. Why are you hanging out with this dude when you have a kingdom to come? But Westside, here's what we need to know about Jonathan at this stage. Jonathan wasn't seeking his kingdom. He was seeking first the kingdom of a different kind. He had covenanted with that kingdom, a kingdom that David was ushering in. But we also see uncommon faithfulness in David as well. David promises that when he comes into power, he will care for Jonathan and his descendants. This is not common. In fact, you can read throughout the Old Testament over and over again that when new monarchy came into place, one of the first things they did was they purged themselves of any leftovers or remnants from the past monarchy. But what we see is we see David not doing that. He does something uncommonly faithful. And does this take place? Yeah, hang right in your Bibles. Go to 2 Samuel chapter 9 just to show it and prove it to you. 2 Samuel chapter 9 introduces one of the greatest names in all the Bible, a name that you should name your sons if you have sons. Chapter 9, Mephibosheth. It's awesome. It's a great name. Right? Lots of options. Lots of short ones you can come up with. Mephibosheth. Right? Just mess up homeroom, right? The first day, first day of school. Your teacher just going, I need time off. Mephibosheth, verse 6. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, fell on his face, and paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, Behold, I am your servant. Verse 7. And David said to him, Do not fear, for I will show you kindness. There it is. There's our word. I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. And I will restore to you all the land of Saul, your father, and you shall eat at my table always. Uncommon faithfulness. So we see this lived out in Jonathan. We see it lived out in David. Jonathan would seek David's kingdom first, and David promised Jonathan his kingdom forever. Let me say that again. Jonathan sought David's kingdom first, and David promised Jonathan his kingdom forever. That's the gospel. That's the gospel. Here's a third thing that stands out about covenant within chapter 20. The covenant is a bastion that demands costly commitment. Look at verses 18 to 34. We'll read it together. Lots of verses, lots of words, but it's good. Look at verses 18. I'll start from there. Then Jonathan said to him, Tomorrow is the new moon, and you'll be missed because your seat will be empty. On the third day, go down quickly to the place where you hid yourself when the matter was in hand and remain beside the stone heap. And I will shoot three arrows to the side of it as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send the young man saying, Go find the arrows. You got to remember, right? Jonathan is Saul's dad. Saul is really a bad spear thrower. So Jonathan probably, like his dad, couldn't shoot at a mark. I don't know if that's true, but I like it. Go find the arrows. If I say to the young man, Look, the arrows are on this side of you. Take them. Then you are to come, for as the Lord lives, it is safe for you and there is no danger. But if I say to the youth, Look, the arrows are beyond you, then go, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. That's good. The king sat in his seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, Something has happened to David. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. Ceremonial clean. Okay, that's what he's referencing there. But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, Why has not the son of Jesse? That's really important. If you like highlighting, underlying, I mean, whatever. That phrase. It's very interesting that Saul starts calling David son of Jesse. We'll get to that in a second. Come to the meal either yesterday or today. Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked to last leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, Let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city. My brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. It's awesome. Right? What the hell? Dude, relax. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse? Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse? To your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. Then Jonathan answered Saul's father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul hurled a spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. You think? Right? And it's like, I don't know what your Christmases are like. Right? But Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger, ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. Stop there. Lots in here. All we really need to know, or I guess better way of putting it, all I'm going to highlight from this is one, the plan that they have hatched gets played out here. And David is proven correct. Saul wants to kill David. He's angry that he's not there. But here's what you need to know, what we all need to know in light of these verses that I just read. There's a lot more going on than simply that. Because what you get in verses 18 to 34 is you get a battle between two kingdoms. Let me explain this again. See if we can walk through this. Look at verses 30 and 31 again, if you don't mind. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. He said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame, to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. There it is. There's the battle. What does dad try to do to son here? Well, he tries to guilt and shame Jonathan. You're making yourself look bad. You're making your family look bad. You're making your mother look bad. He tries to guilt him, tries to shame him. But then he moves from guilt and shame to fear. Verse 31 is a verse of fear. If you follow the son of Jesse, your kingdom will not be established. As long as you follow David, that won't take place. See, the battle here is my kingdom or the kingdom of the son of Jesse. That's the battle line here. Which will I choose? I've said previously that Jesse is a name that will forever be linked to Jesus. Jesus is a son of Jesse. We have a kingdom battle going on here. Jonathan, which will you choose? Of his kingdom, Jesus said to all of us in Matthew 6, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. But what we need to realize, Westside, is that it's not a second best kingdom. It's not a settling kingdom. It's a kingdom that makes all other kingdoms pale in comparison. This fact led Paul to exclaim in Philippians 3, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, my King. He's my ruler. He's my Savior. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things, and I count them as rubbish, as dung, as crap, in order that I may gain Jesus. I've entered into covenant with Jesus, Paul proclaims, and all else becomes strangely dim. The problem with most of us in the church today is we still try to sit at the table and hope we can have both. But that covenant commitment to the son of Jesse does demand a cost commitment to us. Jonathan stands on this precipice, doesn't he? Can you imagine? I mean, I don't know if you've ever had an argument with your parents or a family. Can you imagine the tension here? Staring in the face, right, of his father, shaming, guilting, bringing mom. I mean, no son likes to make their mom look bad, right? I mean, let's put some realness on this. He's standing on this. And his kingdom The possibilities are huge. Will he stay or will he be willing to leave his father and follow the son of Jesse? Again, the call is the same for us. Will it be our kingdom we seek or Jesus? And that question that Saul asks in verse 31, what about your kingdom? Again, it's a decision between dad and Jesus. Jesus actually speaks of this decision that we all have at some point in our lives. In Luke 14:26, Jesus states, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother and his wife and his children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. If you have other preferences, if you have other gods, if you have other things that are more important, you cannot be my disciple. I don't know who said this, who wrote this. I wrote it down and I didn't write who I got it from. So like I always say, if it sounds good, it doesn't come from me. Let me read it for you. This person writes this, true life does not consist in securing you and your kingdom, but in reflecting God's faithfulness in covenant relationship. Jonathan wasn't focused on what he could get, his ambitions, but on what God had given in his providence. That's why we use, by the way, covenant language in connection with marriage. Because marriage, first and foremost, before all things, happiness, kids, right? Bigger house, whatever, is about the reflection of Jesus' covenant love relationship with his bride, the church. That the reason God gave us marriage was to reflect the love of Christ for the church. That it's about the glorification of the Father, his Son, and his bride. Here's the last thing that we see about covenant, this bastion in chapter 20. The covenant is a bastion that provides peace in the midst of confusion. Let me read to the end of the chapter. Verse 35. In the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David and with him a little boy. And he said to this boy, his boy, run, find the arrows that I shoot. What a great job, hey? Wouldn't that be awesome? Little boy, sweet. All right, great, awesome. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, is not the arrow beyond you? Jonathan called after the boy, hurry, be quick, do not stay. Right? Obviously, wording to David, not the boy as much. So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter, and Jonathan gave his weapons to his boy and said to him, go and carry them to the city. And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever. And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. You know, verse 42, the last verse of the chapter, it's almost laughable on the surface. Right? Go in peace as you run for your life. Get what? That's what he's saying. Yeah, my dad, he does want to kill you. Go in peace. How does this, I mean, how do we reconcile this? Well, the peace that Jonathan is referring to here is the peace that covenant provides. Jonathan is not talking about peace that is synonymous with the presence of tranquility. That's not how he defines peace. He says you can have peace because of covenant, even when you're running for your life. The covenant is a bastion that provides peace in the midst of confusion. Biblical peace is a rightness in the center of turmoil. Listen to how Jesus marries these two seemingly inconsistent ideas, peace and turmoil, and how the two can be together and actually coexist. In John 16:33, he says this, "I have said these things to you that in me you may have peace." In the world you'll have tribulation. What? How? But take heart, I have overcome the world. In me you will have peace while you're running for your life. What difference, Westside, does covenant make to us? It makes, again, all the difference in the world. In 1834, Edward Mote was considering the gracious experience of a Christian and wrote the words to the hymn that he entitled, "The Immutable Basis of a Sinner's Hope." A great title. Catchy. One day, while visiting a friend and his sick and dying wife, they read scripture together and also wanted to sing a hymn, but no hymn book could be found. Mote had in his pocket the words to the hymn, to his hymn, and read them to the family. The woman's heart was greatly encouraged by the words and requested to keep them. Mote went home and realized that if these words can help one dying woman, maybe it can help others. So he rewrote the words and added some more verses and included it in his hymns of praise collection. Today his hymn has a different title. It is known as "The Solid Rock." Here are the words. "My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly trust in Jesus' name. When darkness seems to hide his face, I rest on his unchanging grace. In every high and stormy gale, my anchor holds within the veil. His oath, his covenant, his blood support me in the whelming flood. When all around my soul gives way, he then is all my hope and stay. When he shall come with trumpet sound, oh, may I then in him be found, dressed in his righteousness alone, faultless to stand before the throne. On Christ, the solid rock, I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. All other ground is sinking sand." We're a week or so away from the Passion Week. Next Sunday is Palm Sunday. On Thursday of that following week, we celebrate Maundy Thursday, which, as James said to you, comes out of the mandatum Maundy of Jesus to love one another. In that upper room, during the meal, Jesus picked up a cup, the third cup of the meal, a cup that represented the Passover. And in that time, in Luke 22, verse 20, we see this recorded, "And likewise the cup after they had eaten, saying, 'This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood.'" It is a new covenant, but really, and fully, it's a fulfillment of the old. The fulfillment of what the old covenant pointed to, Jesus. And when we say yes to Jesus, entering into that covenant with him, he clothes us. He takes our filthy, dirty rags and he clothes us with garments of praise, robes of righteousness. So when the world sees us, they see Jesus. And his strength becomes our strength. And we fight the same enemy. We are now his. But how? How do we enter? What allows this to take place? Well, it was birthed out of love. For God so loved that he sent Jesus. And he took the walk of death for us. But not with the sacrifice, as the sacrifice. His body broken in two. His blood poured out for us. And it's a covenant that is a fortress in a time of uncertainty. It's a covenant of uncommon faithfulness. He laid down his life for us, but it's a fortress and a covenant that demands a cost, for he did lay down his life for us, but we are called to lay down our life for him. And lastly, it's a fortress that provides peace in the midst of the storms of life. So to go back to the question, who cares? What difference does it make? Again, Westside, all the difference for time and eternity. Would you stand and rise, please, as we respond?